Well, you know what time it is, as Reverend Roxy Hampton always starts off the show, my co-host for the Inside Hour. Hi, welcome to the Inside Hour. Thanks for joining us. And we have a special guest tonight who I'm going to introduce in a moment after I share a little bit about what's been going on in our life, our lives. Recently, I think most of you have been experiencing similar things. I want to, first of all, do like what you always do, give it up to the Creator, because without the Creator, we would be nothing. So I want to thank the Creator for you listeners out there, for Don Newsome and BBS Radio, for our guest, Ed Haslam, who we're going to be interviewing in a minute, and Reverend Roxy Hampton, who always does such a loving job of beginning our program and co-hosting the Inside Hour. So I want to give it up to the Creator for protecting us and serving us and basically making it easy for us to go through the great tribulation period that we're going to be talking about tonight and that we're experiencing. Thanks, Creator. Blessed Messiah Yeshua's name, I thank you for everything that you give us, and thank you for all the blessings. Now, having done that, I want to thank a couple other folks and get into a little bit about what we're engaged in. Our co-sponsor for the Inside Hour is, as you probably know if you've been listening for a while, HealthyWorldDistributing.com. And it's a wonderful place where you can get all of my books, DVDs, CDs, healthcare products, and equipment that is going to be urgent at this time where there is currently a depopulation agenda of the tune of 2/3 of the Earth's population, human population, are targeted for elimination. And that as we engage in the atrocities of the global beast, some call the global industrialists that are operating behind the curtains, the Illuminati, or however you want to call them, the cryptocracy, we have to understand that the public health policies, for instance, such as tuberculosis, skin testing, and vaccinations that we're dealing with, not only in the state of Hawaii, where I'm broadcasting from tonight, but all across the United States. We had a tragedy, an urgency, really, that happened last week in Maryland that gives an indication of where we are going and transitioning in this fascist state of America, Nazi America. You had approximately 2,000 families being cited for not vaccinating their children, and that they were summoned to court and cited on a daily basis, fined $50 a day for the days that they were not coming in and appearing in court and clearing their names and getting their children vaccinated. So that this is a totalitarian, completely fascist, manipulative, intoxicating, genocidal operation under the guise of public health. And unless you're awake and aware of the critical issues at hand, unless you're aware, for example, of what we're doing here in Hawaii, by your support through HealthyWorldDistributing.com, everything that you do, everything that you buy on that site, and we've tried to link it to all sorts of wonderful pieces of information that are life-saving. In fact, you can go on HealthyWorldStore.com and get links to In Lies We Trust. That's the holiday gift that if you haven't received your copy of In Lies We Trust, please, please, please do immediately. Do not pass go. Call, go online, HealthyWorldStore.com, or call this toll-free number, 888-508-4787, and get your copy of In Lies We Trust. It's a gift. It's by donation. We ask for your kindness in realizing that it costs us $11.60 to get you a copy of this life-saving 2.5-hour documentary subtitled The CIA, Hollywood, and Bioterrorism, that contains in it life-saving, absolutely eye-opening documentation and information that is required to completely assess the genocidal capacity of the global beast operating right here in America. So that this is critical information. I want to thank our sponsors for bringing you this information, for sustaining us, for your support and sustenance, and the creators, of course, and this wonderful network called BBS Radio that, again, if you haven't joined up as a member, please do. It's only $2 a month. Gives you full access to all the archives of these wonderful programs. So I'm currently, if you know, I broadcast last week on Tuesday night as the last day that I was in northern Idaho and flew the next morning to where I am now on the Big Island of Hawaii. And indeed, Reverend Roxy was accurate. It's heating up. Things are heating up big time politically on this Big Island of Hawaii insofar as people coming to realize that the genocide is ongoing, that public health is a scam, that the manipulation of the population through contaminated vaccinations and TB skin tests has got to stop, that they're literally violating not only people's bodies but God's great laws that were established by the great people of Hawaii. The sovereignty movement is alive and well in Hawaii. The Kingdom of Hawaii is forthcoming to regain itself, to regain its stature. And on this program, we'll interview in future weeks some people who are leading that movement. It was a blessing to return to paradise from God's country in northern Idaho. It's a great blessing that we have to be able to come between these two places and to be engaged in the ministry operations that we do. And that coming here is very, very interesting to see what's happening politically. You get a different perspective. And I can tell you that the people who are engaged now increasingly in politics, interestingly enough, in Hawaii, from the grassroots level, are really certain to make a huge difference. And so I'm very encouraged from a very, very heartfelt, loving, and positive perspective in realizing that the leaders of the state of Hawaii will soon be proclaiming with dignity the restoration of sovereignty, which is, I think, something that we all really need to look at, not only in Native American populations. And I have you know that the Akaka Bill, which you may have heard, allegedly to restore the freedoms of the Hawaii population, is inadequate at best. At worst, it's a continuation of the genocide. So that these types of political issues are at the forefront here. At the same time, this planet is heating up big time. Reverend Roxy reported accurately. Every night, we're about 8 miles. I'm broadcasting about 8 miles from where the volcano is actually spewing lava into the Pacific Ocean. And I can tell you, it wasn't like this when I left the island about 8 months ago. It had just really become very minimal flow. Now you look out at night and there's a huge aura or halo around the lava that's causing the whole sky to turn beautiful colors. There's a lot of activity that's going on in the earth itself that I believe is associated with the activity that's going on in the people, because that's essentially the understanding of the native Hawaiians, that Pele has a connection and a expression of energy, even potentially vengeance at humanity for not living divinely and appropriately. And that's exactly what it is for all America. It's judgment time. The party's over. After the party, you got to clean up. And this is what we're facing today. We're looking at a lot of mess that's been created because people have been simply unwilling to look at the truth and tell it like it is. So, in essence, I'm really thankful for being here, and I'm really thankful for the work of our guest. Now, let me begin to introduce a scholar, a gentleman, a person who has got a huge heart to contribute to humanity, as he has, in several ways, investigating deep, dark secrets, beginning in the state of Louisiana, down near New Orleans, in a brilliant first book that he published many years ago called Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. Well, Ed Haslam is the fellow that I'm speaking about, and Ed, you're on the line.
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the Inside Hour.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
Now, I have another wonderful book. Give us the title.
It's Dr. Mary's Monkey, and it's a expansion and continuation of the first book. The big difference between the two books is when I did the first book, as you know, I was investigating a claim of an underground medical laboratory that had been developing a biological weapon and was using radiation to mutate monkey viruses. It was an interesting investigation, but I did not have a witness at the time. And when we first met on the air, it was about 12 years ago, I think, 10, 12 years ago. It was after that, it was in 2000, that I finally got the witness. So I now have a person, she's still alive, thank goodness, who was personally involved in this project. She stood there in David Ferry's apartment day after day and did the process of procedures for them to create, to use monkey viruses, which were enhanced by radiation, to create a biological weapon for the purpose of killing Fidel Castro.
Now, folks, let me give you a little bit of background. I'm going to, Ed, correct me if I'm wrong, and please do come in if you've got some commentary. To give you some background, Ed Haslam had written in his first book, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, that there was this secret cancer virus monkey-involved and viral-induced, viral-mutating operation that would induce cancers in New Orleans associated with the Ochsner Clinic. And
well, with Dr. Ochsner's involvement, not the clinic itself.
Oh, okay, with Dr. Ochsner's involvement, not the clinic itself.
Well, let me set the stage on this, because it goes back to the public health issue you were mentioning in your introduction. We roll the clock back all the way to the polio epidemic of the 1950s. Now, this is language which the American media machine wants you to understand from their perspective. They want you to feel the fear of the words epidemic. Now, there was a polio epidemic, and polio is a bad disease, and 100 American children a day were getting polio. The numbers were about 55,000 cases a year. To stop that, and let me talk a little bit about polio here. If you gave 100 school children, if you expose them to polio, and the polio virus is all over the place, what happens is 95% of them, 95 out of the 100, experience no symptoms whatsoever. Polio goes in the mouth and out the other end, and it does not cause a disease for them. Up to 3 or 4 of them get flu-like symptoms. They get a fever and they're okay in a couple of days, and they have no long-term damage. 1 out of 100, occasionally 2 out of 100, experience what is known as polio, and that is the polio virus is able to get through the intestinal wall into the bloodstream, and it gets into the spinal fluid where it attacks the nerves that particularly power the legs, but also the rest of the body. And when that happens in sufficient quantity, then there is a, the symptoms are crippling paralysis and death. And in the 1950s, with their love of machines, they developed these horrible-looking things called iron lungs, which helped the children who were too weak to breathe artificially breathe and keep them alive for a while. And fortunately, those things are now obsolete, but they're part of the memory of polio. What they decided to do was to vaccinate everybody to stop this 1 out of 100 phenomenon without ever really getting into the question of what was going on to violate the integrity of the intestinal walls. And there's a lot of stuff that's interesting to think about if you're as conscious into the health subject as someone like you is, concerning the use of antibiotics and the disruption of the intestinal flora and the ability for things like Candida albicans to take root in the intestinal system and to break down the barrier of the intestinal wall. So what was actually causing the polio vaccine is not necessarily the presence of the polio virus, because it's all over the place. It was some kind of breakdown in the body's normal defense about it. Now, when the Americans took the decided to develop the polio vaccine, they grew it on monkey kidney cells. And the first problem was they had no way of getting all those other monkey viruses that were already in the monkey kidney cells out of the vaccine. So they knowingly and willingly released a vaccine that they knew was contaminated with dozens of monkey viruses. And the interview that's on file at the National Medical Library with Maurice Hilleman, that you were good enough to put on the internet, documents this in spades.
Yeah, now that's in also in the documentary In Lies We Trust, folks. That Hilleman interview is stunning, and the stunning element of it has the capacity to wake people up better than anything else with regard to vaccine risks. This is a must-view for every parent who is thinking about vaccinating their children.
And one of the things I knew you and I were on the same page on from the beginning is we were two of a handful of people who even knew who Hilleman was and what his concerns were. And he was the head of vaccine safety testing at Merck. Now, when they took the polio vaccine over to Scandinavia, the Scandinavian doctors kind of looked at this and said, well, we have a couple of cases of polio a year, but we're not nearly as concerned about it as you are, and we're not about to inoculate our entire population with a bunch of unknown monkey viruses to get rid of a disease we're not concerned about. Now, that perspective is very interesting because it raises the question, why were we so concerned? And one of the reasons we were so concerned was that the President of the United States for 16 years was Franklin Roosevelt, and he had polio. And the polio happened to be attacking the wealthiest families in America. And there was this combination of money and politics and public health hysteria that was really at a fascist level. I mean, they literally had people marching around America in armbands collecting money for the fight against polio. And when they did the polio vaccine and they released hundreds of millions of doses of this contaminated vaccine, they finally figured out, after they had released 100 million doses, that they identified one of the monkey viruses in the polio vaccine caused cancer, and that was SV40. Now, when put yourself in their situation for a minute. When you realize that you've already mass inoculated the entire population of the United States' children with a cancer-causing virus, you do two things. First of all, you declare it a national secret under the needs of national security because you don't want to completely freak out the population because the first thing they're going to want to do is lynch you. Okay? The second thing you do is you get real busy trying to find a solution, what I refer to as a medical Manhattan Project. So the question is, what did they do once they knew? And in their hurry to develop yet another vaccine against the virus that they supposedly accidentally released in the polio vaccine, they needed to mutate it. Now, the reason they needed to mutate it, again, goes back to the polio vaccine. If you understand polio, there are like three flavors of it. There was a heavy, medium, and light. Well, the first strategy, Jonas Salk, and man, I wish I had his PR machine behind me out of Pittsburgh, because nobody's messed up more in medicine, in my opinion, than Salk did, and has walked away with it with a better reputation than he did, and was able to live in Santa Barbara for the remainder of his life. He said, what you got to do, there's only one of those three that is really causing the disease. That's the polio heavy. So what you do is you kill polio heavy by drowning it in formaldehyde, and then you take the dead virus, the corpse of polio heavy, and you inject it into your children. And what happens then is your child's immune system notices there's something that doesn't belong there, and it mobilizes a defense against it. So the next time a live polio heavy comes along, it's ready to fight it. Well, the problem with Salk's vaccine was the method of drowning polio heavy in formaldehyde was flawed and did not work in a production situation. And in 1955, in the most publicized event in the history of medicine, they started to release the polio vaccine. And when they did, it backfired. They actually killed children and crippled children by injecting them with the vaccine. Hang on a second.
I'll take it. So that's exactly when 1960, Bernice Eddy and Sarah Stewart, who were engaged at the Bureau of Biologics of the preliminary to the Food and Drug Administration, pulled some of these vials off the shelf and discovered, lo and behold, they had SV40 in it, cancer virus. They did the studies and found that indeed it had been an inducer of cancer. And this is, I believe, where you're going to is where they started the special virus cancer program. Is that what you're talking about, Ed?
I'm heading there, but let me cover one other step.
Yeah, go ahead.
They handed Bernice Eddy, MD, PhD, was the head vaccine safety tester for the National Institute of Health. And after they had already done a press conference at the University of Michigan and told the entire world that they were about to release this thing, they turned around and handed it to Bernice Eddy to test. Well, she did, and she found live polio virus in there by killing a bunch of monkeys with it. And she said, there is a problem with this vaccine. Do not release it.
Well, so was this before the SV40 discovery by Eddy?
Yeah, this is 1955. The discovery was in 57, and the real whistleblow was in 59. So she says, do not release it. Now, the people who own the laboratories that are making the polio vaccine are not very happy about Bernice Eddy saying that do not release this vaccine right now. There's a problem, okay? So one of these guys was Dr. Alton Ochsner in New Orleans. And Dr. Alton Ochsner was recently, prior to that, in 1949, had been president of the American Cancer Society. He was very plugged in, very powerful person, as head of the American Cancer Society. He sat on the board with Walt Bill Donovan, the man who ran the OSS during World War II and helped found the CIA. And at any rate, Ochsner was so convinced that Jonas Salk's vaccine was safe and that Bernice Eddy was a troublesome bureaucrat in Washington, D.C., who was just trying to cover her flanks, that he decided to publicly inoculate his grandchildren with the polio vaccine in front of the faculty of Tulane Medical School, upon which my father sat, okay? And what happened was, and fortunately somebody warned my father about this, and he did not have us inoculated at the time, but Ochsner's grandson got polio and died, and his granddaughter got polio and was crippled for a period of time in her life and later recovered. So we're talking about a powerful man who knew cancer on one hand and was intimately connected to the polio thing and actually suffered the tragedy of inoculating and killing his own grandson with the polio vaccine. And this was something Bernice Eddy had tried to warn him about. So then...
How's that for karma?
Yeah. And so what happens is... The President of the United States orders the Vice President of the United States to fire the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare in retaliation for this, who was Aveta Hobby. She was the wife of the governor of Texas. And they routed the entire leadership over at the National Institute of Health and replaced everybody. And so this was the biggest blunder in American political history, and it took down a cabinet member in the process, and it was a huge shakeup and everything. And what they did was they pulled the Salk vaccine off the market, okay? I mean, Salk got yanked, all right? And they replaced it by a vaccine that Albert Sabin had developed. And Albert Sabin said, well, you know, you got three flavors of polio here, heavy, medium, and light. You don't need to mess with the heavy one because that's the real dangerous one. If you use polio light, it still causes the immune system to develop an immune response. And therefore, all you got to do is to give everybody polio light, and they will develop a resistance to the polio virus. And that became the famous sugar cube in the little white cup that everybody took. And they re-released the polio vaccine, this time with Sabin's vaccine. And they released hundreds of millions of doses of it. And in 1957, at the height of the time when they were doing this, a woman by the name of Sarah Stewart, who was also up at NIH, she was at the National Cancer Institute, and Bernice Eddy discovered for the first time what they could prove to the satisfaction of the medical staff at NIH that they had identified a cancer-causing virus. And they named it polyoma, S-E, polyoma, S for Stewart, E for Eddy. Polyoma, meaning it caused many types of tumors in many types of mammals. So the discovery of S.E. polyoma was a big event at NCI because it created the funding for an entire new arena of medical research, which was cancer-causing viruses. They couldn't spend the money they were authorized to spend fast enough. I mean, they had more money than they knew what to do with, and they were handing it out to people to buy electron microscopes and do all kind of things with. And when they got that going, they started cataloging all of these monkey viruses and trying to determine who their natural hosts were. Well, they found this S.E. polyoma, which Stewart and Eddy had been using in hamsters and mice and stuff. They found it in its native host, which was the rhesus monkey. Now, what's interesting about the rhesus monkey is, of all the primates, it has the blood which is most similar to human blood, and therefore they like to use it for a lot of research. And one of the things they particularly use it for is growing the polio virus for the polio vaccine. So they actually used the monkey kidneys from the rhesus monkey to make the polio vaccine, and they discovered that the rhesus monkey was the natural host of SV40, which led them to the truly terrifying question of whether the polio vaccine that they had already released was contaminated with a cancer-causing virus. In fact, it was several of them, in fact, but SV40 is the one that had their attention at the time. So they blew the whistle silently. Bernice Eddy actually tried to go public with this, and this was on the eve of the Nixon-Kennedy election. And everybody knows that something freaked Richard Nixon out right before the television debates, and I personally think it was Bernice Eddy's announcement to the Cancer Society that the lauded polio vaccine that Richard Nixon had been running around promoting was contaminated with a cancer-causing virus, and he had just authorized the injection of this into all your children. Now, you want him to be president? You know, that was the political issue involved at the time. And so that brings us up to 1960, and the really disgusting part of the story is at the time of that discovery, late 1959, 1960, they still had millions of doses of this contaminated vaccine on the shelves. And instead of pulling it off of the shelves, they figured, well, we're a couple hundred million doses into this. A couple million more isn't going to be all that bad. And they allowed the contaminated vaccine to be used until 1963. Now, if you look at the statistics on cancer in the United States since the polio vaccine, there has been a massive increase in soft tissue cancers. And by soft tissue cancers, I'm referring to cancers of the breast, the prostate, the skin, which is melanomas, and the lymph system, which is the body's drainage system. So lymphoma, melanoma, breast cancer, and prostate cancer. And the other soft tissue involved is brain cancer, but they didn't, there's a statistical thing you'd have to look at. That was so aggressive that it shows up before their measurement window started, and so the curve is a little flatter. But if those four that I'm talking about, which you can prove, had a massive increase during the 16-year window that they actually measured this, we got back 15 cases of cancer for every one case of polio we got rid of on an annualized basis.
Yeah, what wonderful risk-benefit analysis that is, huh?
Well, this news is so bad, you can at least from one perspective understand why they're not willing to talk about it.
Yeah.
The other issue is, we talked about polio heavy, medium, and light, but they didn't have SV40 heavy, medium, and light. They only had one version of it. And they said, well, gee, it sure would be nice if we had SV40 light so we could use a strategy like Sabin's polio strategy and create a vaccine that would stop this thing or at least help immunize people against it. And they were in a great big hurry because they had already released, you know, a couple hundred million doses of this thing, and my numbers here are all about the United States. Let's not forget they took this vaccine overseas and particularly gave it to the Russians.
Okay? Right.
So they decided that they needed to do something important, something in a hurry, something bold and courageous, and that they did not want to tell the public what they were doing. They set up a linear particle accelerator, which was a machine that creates a beam of radiation, on the grounds of the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital in New Orleans. Now, this is a hospital guarded by U.S. Marines.
Yeah, let me just also interject here. This is where, folks, if you read the book Emerging Viruses, AIDS, and Ebola, or get the new documentary In Lies We Trust, you'll see that they started the special virus cancer program at the same time. Now, special in the military circles connotes secret. So Ed Haslam has just told you that this was not given to the public. This was a secreted program, covert operation, that was heavy duty in so far as looking at what were the cures and causes of cancer, because they had known they had just begun the world's most hideous cancer pandemic. Go ahead, Ed.
Well, so they start, and what they didn't want to tell people in particular was two things. One was that they were doing something very dangerous, which was exposing cancer-causing viruses to radiation. Because while the goal is to create a benign virus, the risk is you can actually create a super disease that nobody's ever seen before, and that even our great gift from the Creator himself, our immune system, doesn't know how to deal with, okay? And that was the part of the thing, first part that they wanted to keep secret. The second part that they wanted to keep secret is they didn't want anybody asking, why are you doing this? Because the answer to that is because we just mass inoculated your children and the human blood supply for the rest of history with a cancer-causing virus. So they were essentially taking the polio vaccine, which was ripe with viruses, and exposing it to radiation. Now, the techniques of filtration and isolating viruses and stuff were not nearly as sophisticated back in the early 1960s as they are today. And some of these viruses, you know, some of them are like the size of basketballs, and some of them like the size of ping pong balls, and some of them are like the size of peas. They travel together in groups, and you can't necessarily get to separate them out with 100% accuracy. So one of the other viruses that was in this vaccine was SIV from the African primates. It is the simian immune deficiency virus. It is the parent virus of HIV, which causes the AIDS epidemic. Now, when you realize that there is the possibility that they hit SIV with radiation and mutated it and changed it into HIV in this activity, you now have what I consider to be a very scientifically plausible theory for the origin of AIDS that makes sense with the epidemiological timeline. Because when the AIDS virus emerged in the 1980s, the epidemiologists did the graphs, they ran the regressions, and they said this puppy started in 1960, which is right at the time frame we're talking about. We're talking about New Orleans in between 1960 and 1963. We find a lot of really suspicious stuff down there. We find that there's a man by the name of Jose Rivera. He's a colonel in the Army. He's an MD. He's working on his PhD in bacteriology. He ran the U.S. Army's laboratory in Japan during Operation Paperclip when they were debriefing the Chinese scientists, the Japanese scientists, on their bioweapons program during World War II. And then he winds up at the National Institute of Health, where he is the director of the Institute of Neurology and Blindness. His specialty is testing biological weapons. Okay, now between these two events, between Japan and coming back to Fort St. Houston in Texas, and going up to Fort Detrick in Maryland to be head of NIH, he spends a year in New Orleans teaching introductory biology to nursing students at Loyola University, a Jesuit-run university, located about 1 mile from the linear particle accelerator I just described. Now, I find that to be an awfully suspicious career move.
Well, it's a great cover.
Yeah, and he's a biological weapons experimental design expert, is in New Orleans at the same time that they're starting these experiments. Now, from the perspective of the people involved, and who did they get to be in charge of this? I think they got Dr. Alton Ochsner. He happens to live 1 mile from the linear particle accelerator. And he brought in Mary Sherman. Mary Sherman was, and that's the Mary in the title, she was from the University of Chicago.
Yeah, give us the title again.
Dr. Mary's Monkey.
Okay, now, folks, you're getting where the title came from.
Right. Dr. Mary is Dr. Mary Sherman. She was a MD from the University of Chicago Medical School. She was trained at the University of Chicago, which is one of the heaviest hitters in the country, where Enrico Fermi was, on the uses of radiation. She understood the issue, she understood the potential, and she ran a cancer laboratory for Dr. Alton Ochsner at his clinic. She also taught at Tulane Medical School. She was technically an orthopedist, which is where my father knew her, because my father also taught orthopedic surgery at Tulane Medical School. And her best friend from the University of Chicago Medical School, when she went there with her, was Sarah Stewart, who was the doctor at NIH NCI, who discovered the polyoma virus, discovered the cancer-causing virus that wound up in the polio vaccine. So these people are a very tight-knit group of people. They're right there in New Orleans. They take this linear particle accelerator and they hide it in something called the Infectious Disease Laboratory Building, just to keep out the casual traffic. And they engage in what they would describe as a noble but secret set of experiments to try to develop an anti-cancer vaccine in time to stop the epidemic. Now, the background event in all of this is what changes the flavor of it. Fidel Castro takes over Cuba. The anti-communist hysteria in the United States is triggered by his alliance with the Soviet Union. The Soviets are very upset over the fact that the United States has put offensive nuclear missiles in Turkey and would like to demonstrate to the United States government what it feels like to have somebody stick a nuclear missile in your rib. And they decide to move nuclear missiles into Cuba so that they've got a bargaining chip with the United States to get those missiles out of Turkey. And the news that there are nuclear missiles in Cuba leads to this hysterical interpretation that Castro is about to start World War III, and if we could just get rid of Castro, we could stop World War III, just like the theory that if we had gotten rid of Hitler, we could have stopped World War II. I'm not sure if either one of those is historically correct, but the point is it was justification in New Orleans for dramatic action. And nobody in New Orleans was more hysterically anti-communist than Dr. Alton Ochsner, and so much so that he started a special organization to create anti-communist propaganda called INCA, which was the Information Council for the Americas. And they shipped, their overt operation was to ship radio debate interviews all over Latin America so that they could teach people about the horrors of Castro in Cuba and what it was like to have your sugar mill taken away from you and your sugar plantation taken away from you and your mattress factory taken away from you and all of that. And being from New Orleans and having heard the rumors and scuttlebutt at the time, I frequently heard Dr. Ochsner referred to as a right-wing crackpot. But the fact, when you have a right-wing crackpot who's got millions of dollars and connections to the intelligence community, you have a different type of situation on your hand, particularly when he's got access to a linear particle accelerator and a bunch of monkey viruses. Now, I have Dr. Ochsner's FBI file, and we see that Dr. Ochsner had numerous secret relationships with various U.S. government agencies over several decades. And at the time frame we're talking about, 1957, 1959, there are actually documents in his file signed by J. Edgar Hoover himself clearing Dr. Ochsner for the highest level of secrecy authorized by the United States government, that being a sensitive position. And so there's clearly, Ochsner is clearly involved in a secret operation. We found the wiring for this linear particle accelerator at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital where we had suspected that it was all along. We tracked down the guy who built the linear particle accelerator, and he gave us a description that matched the stuff we found. We're getting very tight on all this stuff. And in 1967, and we all know Kennedy was killed in 63, just to create the landmark on the timeline. And that's right around the time your special virus program starts. I would date it to July 22nd, 1964. If you want a particular date, I'll tell you why in a little bit. But, and Mary Sherman, who was running the cancer lab at Ochsner Clinic and was involved in this project at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital, she winds up getting murdered in 1964, in July of 1964. And her murder, which was conspicuously covered up, a very bizarre murder and officially never solved, it was one of the main things that I investigated in the case. My book might be looked at as a cold case investigation into her murder.
Now, is this the Mary Ferry, or is this the Dr. Mary's monkey?
Well, it's Mary Ferry. She's the Mary of Mary Ferry and the monkey virus. But that, the book is kind of expanded and retitled.
Oh, okay. So the new book is basically Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, second edition with expanded research.
Right, and The Witness and more stuff in it.
Sweet.
So,
and by the way, folks, Ferry is the Ferry from the Kennedy assassination, right, Ed?
Right, which is exactly where I'm going next. In 1967, when Jim Garrison is investigating the Kennedy assassination in New Orleans, one of his prime suspects is a man named David Ferry. And in Playboy magazine, October 1967, and I have the issue on my website, by the way, the exact quotes from this, and the website is Dr. Mary's Monkey, and Dr. is spelled out there, D-O-C-T-O-R, Mary's, no apostrophe, of course, drmarysmonkey.com. He says in that interview that he has discovered that Mary Sherman, who's already been murdered by this time, was involved in some kind of underground medical laboratory involving cancer with David Ferry. So Mary and Ferry were involved in this underground medical laboratory. And that claim was something that I heard personally, because I'm from New Orleans, and I was in New Orleans at the time in the 1960s, and I was told by somebody very close to Garrison's investigation that Garrison thought that they were using this to develop a biological weapon to kill Fidel Castro. And that, you know, people don't write stuff like this down if they're involved in it. I had to, you know, treat it as a rumor, but it was definitely a rumor that I heard. And my experience is about half the rumors I hear are true, and so you got to try to sort out which ones are and which ones aren't. But it was enough for me to publish the initial version of the book, because I was trying to at least get the story framed and articulated and in the conversation so people could talk about it. And one of my hopes was that there might be somebody around who was involved in the project who'd be willing to come forward and speak. Okay, and in the year, November of the year 2000, my phone rang, and it was 60 Minutes, the CBS news show. And they said they were investigating a woman with an interesting story and background, and that she said that she had been in the laboratory that I wrote about in my book, and that I want to talk to them. And frankly, I didn't, but they were persistent, and I finally talked to them and stuff. And they introduced me to a woman by the name of Judith Berry Baker, who is a very interesting woman for a couple of reasons. One is that when she was still in high school, she was a science superstar whose dream in life was to find the cure for cancer. She won national level, I mean like the Westinghouse science competitions. She received funding from various sources, one of which was the National Science Foundation. She had a laboratory set up on the grounds of her high school that included X-ray equipment and mice, and she was giving the mice cancer, and she was giving the mice cancer faster than they were able to do it at the big national laboratories. So we got this weird situation where this high school kid is outperforming the national laboratories. So they put her in an accelerated training program, and they send her up, the hitters at the American Cancer Society send her up to the Roswell Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York, where she is trained by the George Moore and Grayson Morand, who were the guys that published Human Susceptibility to Simian Tumor Virus. They're all up there at Buffalo. And she gets trained in the techniques of handling cancer-causing viruses. Then she goes back to Florida and gets invited to come to New Orleans by Dr. Alt Noschner to work with Mary Sherman on a project which is explained to her to be sensitive. Okay, she gets in New Orleans and gets hooked up with her little people, and she is provided a cover job at the Riley Coffee Company. Now, for anybody who's familiar with the JFK assassination literature, the moment you say Riley Coffee Company, you go, isn't that where Lee Harvey Oswald worked? Yes, it is. And Judith Berry Baker starts work at the Riley Coffee Company on May 10th, the same day that Lee Oswald did. They came from the same employment agency. They worked for the same length of time. They were both approved for employment by William Moynihan, who was an ex-FBI agent. And what their real job was. Judah's job was to go over to David Ferry's apartment and do these experiments to create the biological weapon, and Lee Oswald was assigned to be her bodyguard and escort because he knew the city and, you know, he was a Marine and could take care of her and make sure she got to where she was going. And Judith kind of gets lost going around the corner if she's by herself. And several days, and he helps her get an apartment. Lee lives on Magazine Street, works at the other end of Magazine Street, so he takes the Magazine Street bus down there, gets Judith an apartment right there by the thing. So they ride the bus to work each day and ride the bus home each day. And when they get to work and they're on the clock, they sneak out and go over to David Ferry's apartment where boxes, like 50 mice in a box, 50 dead mice in a box, are brought over. And Judith goes through and figures out which ones have the biggest tumors in them. They cut open the mice, they take out the tumors, they drop them in a blender, they make up this sauce, and they put it in test tubes, and they send it back to Mary Sherman with her notes and comments on how much the tumors weighed and what great progress they're making in this. And then that sauce, the product as they called it, is taken back to the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital, exposed to more radiation, brought back and re-injected into the mice, which are in an apartment across the street from David Ferry's apartment, which I write about in Dr. Mary's Monkey. And they do this until they perfect a biological weapon. Then they inject it into a bunch of monkeys. It kills all the monkeys. That's great. They want to test it on a human. They take it to a mental hospital. They bring in a prisoner from Angola Penitentiary. They put the prisoner into the Jackson Mental Hospital. They inject the prisoner with the biological weapon, and the prisoner dies. Okay? This is their proof positive test that their biological weapon works, and then they give it to Lee Oswald for him to take and down to Mexico City for him to try to get it into Cuba so that people can, friendly to the American intelligence, can inject it into Fidel Castro, telling him it's a vaccine or something. So that's the basic story there. And what we have is Judith is a very credible person, in my opinion. Nigel Turner produced a hour-long documentary on her that was aired on the History Channel. No longer available from the History Channel, but I have a link into that video on my website, Dr. Mary's Monkey. There's an interview with me talking about this whole subject and Judith on there. There's a witness, a person who was in New Orleans and knew Lee Harvey Oswald and Judith Baker together as a couple, who talks about how she knew them and her proximity to all these people. And there's an overview of the Garrison investigation, because Jim Garrison obviously had his investigation shut down, and he thought they were shutting him down because he was getting very close to discovering who the assassins of the president were. My analysis is a little bit different. I think he was shut down because he accidentally stumbled on the Ferry Sherman biological weapon laboratory that involved Clay Shaw, involved Alton Ochsner. And it was an authorized effort coordinated between the CIA and the Mafia to create a biological weapon, and they were not about to admit that. And when you start to realize all of that, now you realize why they cannot let Lee Harvey Oswald into a courtroom and start talking, because he knows too much.
Well, that's a wonderful summary, Ed.
Well,
a lot of wonderful research. Fascinating.
And it's a difficult bunch of material, but if you want to know, if you want to get the underpinnings, and I've got a couple other things we can talk about in the last couple of minutes, but the one is this fairy tale that AIDS came from Africa, okay, which is being promoted through the media, which is a really weird set of circumstances. This all goes back to a discovery, quote, made by a woman by the name of Beatrice Hahn at the University of Alabama, where she found HIV in chimpanzee cells, okay? Well, what they didn't tell you was that the chimpanzee that from whose cells she got the thing, a chimpanzee named Marilyn, was in Colston's laboratory in New Mexico. Colston ran the laboratory in Alamogordo, which is the White Sands Missile Range. His clients were NASA and the Air Force and other people. And the moment that AIDS was discovered in San Diego in the summer of 1981, Colston got his hands on AIDS blood and injected it into his female chimpanzees to see if it was transferred from mother to child. One of those chimpanzees was Marilyn. Marilyn dies in 1984. Colston has some cells from her body cryovac'd and throws them in a freezer in his office. When Colston dies in the 90s, somebody cleans out his office, finds these things, and sends them to their friend down at the University of Alabama, who says, "Eureka, I have found the origin of AIDS." And just because she happens to know how to do PCR DNA testing, or RNA genetics testing, there's no DNA in AIDS, but is able to get into that, she's declared the expert. And she says, "Well, gee, all we have to do now is go find this thing in the jungles of Africa, and we'll be able to prove it." Meanwhile, they were re-releasing chimpanzees from the primate labs back into the jungles. Okay, so the whole thing is a well-orchestrated fairy tale to try to create a plausible explanation for AIDS. Now, the most recent scientific thing that's come up is they have found AIDS in the Haiti, in blood from people in Haiti from the 1960s, which is fine, because that's kind of what I've always suggested they did, was they put it in Haiti. But the first year that, or 3 years after they started measuring the AIDS epidemic, they had 9,000 cases in the United States and 2,000 cases in Africa. So how could this thing have been in Africa for centuries and not have it progress when we had an explosion of it here in the United States? And then now they got, 40 million people in Africa with AIDS. You know, I mean, the graphs don't make sense with all this. To me, it's just another orchestrated propaganda operation to confuse people.
Yeah, well, that's for certain. You know, the conclusion that I drew is that the hepatitis B vaccine from 1972 to 74, the pilot studies that were being produced in contaminated chimpanzees and rhesus monkeys, that was actually given to the gay men in New York City, blacks in Central Africa, and the Willowbrook State School mentally retarded children under Army contract, that was the real trigger for the international AIDS pandemic. The women in Haiti, the nurses particularly in Haiti, were given the vaccines because they were meant to give the vaccines, and so they were trained by saying, "Well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to give you the vaccine first so that you can get used to it." Those Haitians were French-speaking, and they were brought into Africa to administer the vaccinations. That's, according to my research, how the Haitians ended up having a higher rate of HIV those early days of AIDS.
Yeah, and there's a blowback from that involving gamma globulin, because gamma globulin is a immune system booster made from distilled human blood. I don't even know if they still make it anymore, but they used to give it to people for international travel. It became a fad amongst the American gay community, and they would go down to Haiti, pay people $1 a draw and take blood all day, and without filtering it, because they didn't know about AIDS in it, they sent it back to the United States, used it to make gamma globulin, and then injected the gamma globulin into gays in New York and L.A.,
yeah,
San Francisco. And so I think that's another vector, I think it's the correct term, on it in terms of the outbreak, the disease.
Yeah. You know, we have a guest. I don't know, it's kind of late in the show to have a guest come. You're on the air with... Hey, well, that folks, you heard it. Sorry about that. My watch is running a little bit behind. This is Dr. Len Horowitz thanking Ed Haslam for joining us on the Inside Hour, and I want to encourage you to stay on BBS Radio for Don Nikoloff, whose show is coming right up. Thanks for staying with us. We'll talk to you next week. Be blessed. Bye for now.